Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison, our monthly meeting and discussion. Our presenter today is Mary France, who will be talking to us on bioethics beyond Terry Schiavo. Thank you very much for doing this, Mary.
This is a fairly informal presentation, but I'm probably okay if we hold questions till the end. My talk is based on a book of the same title, which I published in 2009, and I read it once and said, hey, that would be a good subject for the humanists, and then I returned it to the library and didn't think any more about it till Bob was looking for another program, and I said, I'd do that, and then I broke down and bought the book, and I'm very glad I did. Howard Brody is a very forward-looking medical ethicist. He's been practicing in the field. He came from family practice and into the field of bioethics in 1972. And in recent years, he's focused on, more tellingly, on the interface of ethics with other related fields. I gave a handout which has a review of the book, which you don't have to read it now. But if you look on the right-hand side, there's some snippets from an article which I will later hand you in its entirety. I suggest looking at the first paragraph to give you the feel of what ethics is up against. I forgot to bring along my little red book that I got when I graduated from medical school in 1951, the AMA Principles of Medical Ethics. It's a 20-page book, small. And there's only a few paragraphs about the character of the physician and the physician's obligations to their patients. The majority of the book is about the physician's obligation to other physicians. Uh-huh. Now, this was certainly the field, but it is important, as I can testify, because as a primary care physician myself, it was not infrequent for me to refer a patient to a specialist and never see the patient again, because the specialist would then say, oh, this guy has a heart problem, so I will send him to a heart doctor. This guy has diabetes, he needs to see the diabetes specialist, and these were problems I had been caring for right along. So that was significant. There are also some paragraphs about never advertising to the public, which unfortunately have been banished, and not to have a financial interest in anything other than the physician's own competence. In other words, the physician shouldn't own shares in a drugstore or a medical supply. But the paragraphs about the physician's character and personality were very significant, unprejudiced service to all, regardless of their political or personal orientation, privacy about patient affairs. As Bob says, we're not going to talk about anything personal. And being honest towards patients and families with regard to diagnosis and prognosis. Back in this era, it was not particularly prevalent to talk to the patient about a bad prognosis, but you had to talk to somebody about it, usually the family. Well, ethics in general is an ancient subject. I can't begin to tell you all the ethics that's been in print, but I thought of Confucius. Confucian analects are certainly about dealings between people. The Old Testament is full of ethics, some of which seems a little unethical to our present time. Aristotle's ethics. Aesop's fables are full of ethical issues. Hippocrates described the medical ethics of his time, which is still pretty pertinent. When I graduated, we had the Hippocratic Oath, and as far as I know, they still do that for medical graduates. The idea of having a specific academic discipline of ethics first appeared in the early 70s, and the term bioethics didn't really appear before that. Medical ethics, yes, but bioethics not. At that time, there were two major trends, one of which was the application of ethics to medical decisions, which had been considered for over 100 years, and the other was a relationships of humans to the natural world. I'm telling you this just to tell you I'm not going to talk about the traditional subjects of medical ethics, end-of-life decisions, reproductive ethics, including the question of when life begins, research ethics, informed consent with the corollary of truth-telling. Those are very interesting subjects, but I'm not going to talk about them today. Maybe some other time. Ethics departments originally were in the philosophy divisions of the universities, but medical ethics became a department in the medical schools. Brody asks us to consider a much broader healthcare ethics. For example, dealing with access to care, what we call patient or person-centered care, decision-making while avoiding power disparities, he's very strong on this, and stewardship of human and environmental resources. So that first definition about the relationship of humans to the natural world deserves to be revisited. The academic tendency, some of you who are in academia know that there's a tendency to work in silos. One's here, one's here, one's here. Brody, his current title is the director of the Institute of Medical Humanities in Texas. And that's his emphasis on pulling in studies in other fields, including narrative, literature, history, religion, social sciences. He believes bioethics is a practice, not a body of knowledge, and the practice involves moral perception, reflection, and action. And I might parenthetically add, those virtues are not confined to ethicists. They're part of everybody's life. To start with narrative, reading and writing are much more interesting and memorable in narrative form. And it opens us to viewpoints other than our own by transporting us to another situation, another time, another place, another person. I thought of Huck Finn when he is ruminating on whether to turn in his friend and companion Jim as an escaped slave and earn the reward and also be doing his patriotic duty. But he ruminates for several pages, and his final decision is it's better to do the right thing, even though he firmly believes he's risking going to hell. An extensive exploration of another culture is in a more recent book, which some of you may have read, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. This is about a Hmong family in the 80s, I think, who were faced with a severely handicapped baby for whom there really wasn't much hope of cure. There were conflicts between a genuinely compassionate medical team who wished to help the child and the family's cultural values. The medical team had their way with many somewhat fruitless interventions. Finally, the family took the baby home and provided total care till the end of the infant's life, which was several years of age. But by the end of the infant's life and the end of the book, at least some of the medical and social worker team had undergone profound changes in their own understanding and appreciation of other cultural values. And I'm sure you could give me many other narratives you have read that are focused on medical, ethical decisions. As far as history is concerned, there used to be a course in medical school of history of medicine that usually involved who discovered what and when and so on and so forth, which is interesting, but it should be concerned also with the culture in which various medical systems developed. And we can all think of things that we might laugh at as being pretty quaint and antiquated, such as believing that malaria was caused by bad air. And it's quaint, ignorant, but we can put ourselves into that time and place and perhaps be a little more tolerant of that thought. And I'm sure that future historians will look back on modern times and say, how could you have believed that? In my close to 60 years, and my husband's more than that, in practice, I can assure you that many of my cherished beliefs about treatment and methods have quietly gone to their well-deserved rest. So we have to be we finally learned we have to be sort of humble about that. Well, just look at what you hear about diets. Low-fat diets, high-fat diets, low-carbohydrate diets, high-carbohydrate diets, eat grapefruit, eat. It goes on and on. As far as religion, this encompasses culture and narrative, but it's more from the point of view of ultimate values. In our society, we tend to glorify individualism and autonomy. In fact, the principles of ethics, the four principles begin with autonomy. But most indigenous African and other cultures place more value on the family and community. And there's an African ethicist who says, in Africa, we don't view the individual as morally complete until in the context of the clan, the family, the tribe. And if we consider ethics as simply a set of principles here, here this, therefore that, and formal logic, we're leaving out the awe and mystery that a religious view invites. He gives a very nice quote, "The religious essence does not lie in the answer, but in taking the question seriously and with compassion." And this is true not only in what we might consider as traditional religions, but it's certainly a humanist point of view. In the social sciences, we gain insights into many of the concerns which Brody explores in the rest of his book. What's the ethical way to treat mentally and physically challenged individuals? What about the global problems of poverty, access to resources? What about racial and other disparities, as our speaker this morning so eloquently described? And the overall paternalistic culture of medicine, which is certainly much better than it was when I started out in school, but I'm sure you all have examples of feeling you were treated paternalistically, even by a female. Population health is intricately related to environmental ethics, and Brody cites the egregious example of Hurricane Katrina as an environmental disaster with enormous public and individual health consequences, regardless of all the other consequences. And Katrina was not only a natural disaster, but it was magnified hugely by past decisions which had been made, not involving those most affected, tilted by the interests of wealthy and powerful elites. The response to the crisis was similarly divided along the lines of wealth and privilege. In fact, just a few days ago, we didn't get the whole story, but we heard a comment on a news broadcast that the trailers that FEMA had finally provided for the homeless people were now to be removed, whether the people had other housing or not. If they weren't removed, the people would be fined $500 a day. I hope that doesn't happen. They're doing it. Brody points out that the fine points of traditional bioethics, stem cell research, cloning, genetic engineering, must seem pretty irrelevant in the life and death situations facing the majority of the world's population. And he says these are legitimate concerns for bioethics. The theme of power relationships among various groups weaves through the entire book, starting with feminist politics, but he goes on to include the relationships between the disabled and the able-bodied, and certainly the racial power relationships. Healthcare reform is a case in point. Oregon spent years developing a public consensus on their priorities for the state-funded Medicaid. At the time, they had to overcome quite a few hurdles and roadblocks before they even had permission to do this. But they had focus groups, interest groups, discussion groups all over the state trying to be as inclusive as possible as to what services should have priorities. You couldn't do everything for everybody. What should you do? And they actually made a list, I don't know how familiar you are with this, of medical services in the order of their importance and urgency. And depending on the state budget for Medicaid, they would draw a line on that list. This was surprisingly popular. People had had input into it, and it was quite effective for a few years, but then it gradually weakened for a variety of political and economic reasons, and not the least of which is the uncontrolled increase in medical costs. So you got a lot less bang for your buck as the years went by. But the point I'm making is that the planners did include all interested parties in a process that is very slow, but people who undergo this process are thereby invested and interested in the result. Brody wonders if the Clinton plan, remember the Clinton plan, might have been ultimately successful if it had been structured with this initial just program of debate and consultation of the entire affected public, leading to a pilot program or programs rather than a plan of thousands of pages presented to all and turned down for lots of reasons. Now, when we come to, in our own country, the care of individuals, we all have a vision of what our ideal provider would be: approachable, knowledgeable, compassionate, and with lots of time, whether it's a physician or a nurse practitioner, who could lead us through the maze of more specialized care if necessary. These model primary care providers are a rare breed and becoming increasingly rare, there again for a variety of reasons, because everybody wants one, but I shouldn't speak as if I cared myself about the rewards, but the financial and prestige rewards were not comparable to those of the super specialists. And I'm sure we can all, and probably some of you will want to relate some horror stories of care going awry in the highly technological milieu of a modern hospital or clinic. There is a strong movement in the medical profession, and Brody believes ethicists should be deeply involved in this, which is patient-centered care, where the patient more or less calls the tune, or at least puts the perspective into the entire running of the establishment, from how long I have to wait for an appointment to who sees me, so forth and so forth. Now, incidentally, if the same physicians become a power lacking recipients of care themselves, they might develop quite a huge insight. And perhaps we shouldn't have to be required to have these unfortunate experiences before we can learn to see, quote unquote, to move to a different viewpoint, making our decisions more appropriate and with more input. Back to the research ethics, and now I will pass out this whole article, which I'm sure you've read enough of those snippets to realize how appalling this whole business was. I better keep one for me. This happened in the 1940s. The U.S. Public Health, the National Health Service, National Institutes of Health, it was a public health funded investigation of how you could treat venereal diseases, including syphilis and other sexually transmitted diseases. Now, back in the 40s, which is about when I graduated from medical school, was the initial treatment of syphilis with penicillin instead of the lengthy course of painful injections of arsenic. So this was new and it was exciting, and you can imagine that as far as these doctors were concerned, this was really important work. Goals were ideal, commendable. See if there would be more acceptable prophylaxis that perhaps could be used after potential infection. If any of you were old enough to be in the Army and be issued those pro kits of the 40s that you were supposed to use after you had sexual exposure, very few soldiers would use them because these chemicals they had to apply were extremely painful. So this, you can't question that the goals were good, but the idea of taking a captive audience, took prisoners, mental health patients, soldiers, and infected them with syphilis first by infecting prostitutes and then sending the prostitutes where the potential victims were. Well, I'm sure you'll enjoy reading this whole article. They did treat everybody, probably.
Yeah.
The record suggests that towards the end, it says only 76% of those who were directly inoculated and infected received adequate amounts of penicillin, which in the early years of penicillin was a lot of penicillin and a lot of very frequent injections would be a very costly and cumbersome process. And that's probably why the program folded without them ever finishing their study or publishing it, because they ran out of money. I think towards the top of the right-hand column, why it implies that even the doctors who were doing it were getting a few discomforting feelings about what they were doing. But this was not uncovered until recently by this medical historian. And so when she first presented her results, only about 20 people were there for the talk, the meeting, and it didn't get any press coverage. And later she forwarded a draft to the former director of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who sent it up the chain of command. Finally, in July of 2009, I guess, the CDC looked at the files and said, yeah, that's what happened. That's awful. And they're considering, well, there should be monetary compensation for the victims of the descendants, but the main message, I think, is that there should be, and there is, a lot more oversight of what happens with research. That is certainly an egregious example of lousy research ethics. I can't possibly tell you about the whole book. I'll be like a fifth grader who in the book report says, this was a good book, you should read it yourself. Total of the book review. But I'd be happy to have any discussion and answer questions if I can. If not, I'll take a note of what questions you have. So if you want
to, I can.
Yes.
Did this occur in Guatemala because they were going under developed country and utilizing their people as dispensable?
Well, that's the common thing in research in the developing world.
That's unethical, too.
It's unethical unless it's a fully funded study providing adequate treatment with adequate knowledge.
Did the people know it was being done?
Yeah. But they didn't know it. No, this was totally unethical. And it was unethical according to those standards. You can't say, oh, everything was different then. It was not.
So
we were in school then.
It was never ethical.
Is there any way that this study could have been ethical?
They were doing it to protect our soldiers. Why not tell our soldiers? This is what we're going to do. Would you like to sign up for this study? Yeah. Why take some prisoners in an underdeveloped country?
This study is kind of an innocuous way to say it.
Well, there was a study. It was a research study.
Yeah, but if it's internalized by using a body and injecting it with something poisonous, that's not a very good way to say it. It's a study. It sounds like it's unethical.
Yes, I agree with you.
Well, that brings up the point. Supposing Lindbergh abuses resulted in important knowledge, should the knowledge be suppressed?
Well,
I'm talking about the war crimes.
Well, yes, the question of
research done with the Nazis.
That has been come hitting the medical and scientific news probably ever since the Nuremberg trials, but that should the work that occurred under duress during Nazi German years, the medical research, should that research be thrown away or should the results be kept? And that's the kind of question you can't really answer. You can just say, on this hand, this, on this hand, this.
What did they do with that information from the German studies?
Isn't that public knowledge now, the results of all the studies?
Did they use it then?
No. So more of the debates have occurred, should these people be recognized, the people who did it?
They should be punished.
And the subjects compensated.
Yes.
Right.
Or the relatives.
Or the relatives, right, since they're probably no longer with us.
You'll see at the end of her article, she talks about the infamous Tuskegee study.
Oh, that was interesting.
This was in the around about 1910-20 sort of time when they didn't they followed the natural history of the syphilis patients. They didn't infect them,
but there was no.
But they didn't treat them, and they just followed the natural history. This is what
Mary,
happened.
There's a question over here.
Yes.
Well, I was going to say, I think these things continue now. For example, the movie The Constant Gardener that talked about people, which was based on truth, that talked about people in Africa being used to test aid drugs and being treated in which they would die and not being acknowledged, but being told they were being helped. And in the WikiLeaks thing, there was a thing about Pfizer, the pharmaceutical company, developing some antibiotic and experimenting on it with children in Africa where they died, where awful things happened to them. And again, they weren't told that these were, you know, it was in the guise of, oh, we're giving you something to help you or be good. So I think these things continue.
Oh, yeah, they still can. And I think the story isn't told on the particular thing you're talking about, but there's no question Pfizer has been trying to conceal the data, but to what extent it was that harmful is not clear. I think it was a meningitis drug, and the mortality rate for meningitis is Africa. In Africa is enormous anyway.
So. Well, they pay money to fix, so apparently they felt guilty.
Yeah.
I have a question that's going to take us in a different direction, I think. I have obviously been to doctors, and those doctors have something, specialists in some cases, to your point about how medical the science works today. I'm very interested in your opinions on someone's personal beliefs and ethics and how that influences how they treat patients. I do feel that some of the doctors that I've seen have had a personal belief system that has influenced my treatment in ways that I don't like. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that and how common.
Has it been made clear to you when the doctor says, I don't believe in abortion, so I can't take care of you?
In some cases, yes.
But if that, in that case.
But in some cases, no.
We had a doctor in our clinic who, since his retired many years ago and died, but he didn't believe in contraception. But he not only would not prescribe contraceptives or send them to somebody who would, he would tell them horror stories about the awful things that were going to happen if they used contraception.
So it was sort of an anti-contraception message.
I'm not sure that our clinic had any way of dealing with that.
How was that not breaking the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, the Hippocratic Oath is of its time. You know, I will not procure an abortion or do anything to prevent a pregnancy. I forget the wording of it.
Is it still required of medical students?
It's kind of a tradition.
So it's not very
like
observed.
Singing O Christmas Tree.
Okay. I had a question on that line. It seems to me it's unethical for a pharmacist to refuse to fill a prescription.
No, this is a current, much discussed ethical issue, and certainly as individuals, physicians and pharmacists have some rights of conscience. But if they're the only game in town, do they have a right not to provide the service? We have a Catholic hospital in Monroe, and within the last few years, with a little bit of pressure from the Planned Parenthood of the Wisconsin, which is trying to, in the legislature, I think, they would not tell patients in the emergency room who had been raped that there was a morning after pill that they could get. But then with the full blessing of the hospital administration, they changed that policy. So they're not required to tell that.
I worked in a Catholic hospital around the late 60s, early 1970, and the physicians were not allowed to tell their patients about contraceptives.
But I'm sure they did.
Some did and some didn't. Yeah. And I remember treating a little girl whose mother said, she was one of like 12 or 14, and the mother, and she had been burned by falling out of a crib into it, like mother had a steam thing for bad coal. And the mother said, well, you know, the first five or six I could handle all right. Mm-hmm. But then after that, it was just too much. And so she had kids, you know, meted out to all of her relatives because it was just more than she could handle. But she had no, that was her primary hospital. She didn't even have like a concept that it was possible to control your family. I mean, it wasn't like she actively rejected it. She didn't know.
Mm-hmm. But these issues, a physician's personal beliefs that influence the way he or she treats his patients can have a big difference in the treatment that you get or what you're told. Mm-hmm. Your point. I wish that each physician would have a little brochure of him or herself.
A little biography.
Well, choose not to go.
I really would read that and
I would say that is advice to give to potential patients when you consult a new doctor. Say, I really like to get acquainted with you, and I have certain issues, especially about reproductive issues. I want to know what's just in. And that's perfectly legitimate. Or about the care of the dying. There are some doctors who will not honor a person's wish not to have extreme measures of treatment.
Right. I want to point out that individual doctors or nurses' opinions or whatever are not enough. Also, it's a matter of who owns the hospital. Mm-hmm. And we'll get back to the Catholics. Mm-hmm. There were just stories in the newspaper just last week, a couple of them, and I don't remember some of the fine details, but they have to do with Catholic-owned hospitals, including St. Mary's here in Madison, in which the hospital management through the, I guess, Catholic Church is telling their employees, nurses and doctors, that if they don't follow the official line of the Vatican and these issues of birth control especially, they're likely to be fired from their jobs. This has just been in the news the last 3 days.
So it doesn't just go back to 1970,
no?
And we're talking about that article told you what percentage of hospitals in Wisconsin are owned by the Catholics, and it's a very high percentage, way over half.
They've been very successful, and they have, their hospitals are generally very good, wonderful care, but our Catholic hospital may be an exception because our CEO and our CMO are both good Catholics, but they believe that the care of the patient comes first, and they know they are the only game in town. They know they serve a wide variety of patients, and that patient care is the primary.
I just had a sort of minor question on these referrals. Twice in our family, we've had family physicians refer us to specialists.
Yeah.
And these doctors, these primary care doctors, seemed very concerned about us, and they were very concerned, and we knew them for a while. They referred us to specialists, and that was the end of it. They never, either they or their nurse or anybody else, ever called and said, well, how did that work out? Did you guys die? You're asked. And you think, if somebody asks me who a good logger is, I'll tell them, and then I'll call back and see if they've got a job the guy did. Mm-hmm. But the doctors didn't do that. It seemed genuine when they were talking to us, but the minute they referred us to a specialist, never heard from again.
Yeah, I'm not trying to make any apologies for that. It's really up to the doctor that gets the referral to send the information back.
But you think out of curiosity, I mean, if he cared as much about me as he seemed to, you would think he would have checked to see whether I did all right.
But he may have automatically gotten a report back from that.
But he didn't communicate it.
I would like to know that he read it.
And that's the kind of
thing. And that he read it when he got the report back.
Well, when we're talking about patient-centered care, this is one of the kind of things we're talking about.
It's a simple thing.
Somebody, the nurse or medical assistant could call and say, how did that go?
I just want to add that in the last numbers of years, medical care is a business. And the emphasis seems to be on proactivity on the part of the patient. And you, as the consumer, are reinforced to get second opinions, get third opinions, be assertive, get your test results, ask questions. And if your physician doesn't call, call him. Because they're dealing with countless people, and to you, he's everything, and to him, you're one of a group.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the responsibility for your care is turning more and more to the customer. And it's seen as money. And hospitals are competing for your dollars. So if you have a doctor that you think should be more interested in providing results and discussing them, then you should call him up, make an appointment, go in and say, hey, listen, what I really need from you is to review these test results with me in one way or another, because I'm looking at you as my medical anchor. And thus, you have the responsibility. And you may get that dialogue. And if you don't, then you have to shop for another physician. And that's how it's changing. Everybody is competing towards centers of excellence that are money-making. If the centers of excellence in these facilities are not money-making, I'm closing them down. They can't survive.
This also, I think Sidel points out, one of Brody's points, that yes, you would be assertive. Dave would be assertive. But what about the powerless people who are used to being kind of put down? You don't matter. You're a disabled person. You're a black person.
Well,
you're a poorly educated person. They aren't going to do that.
But there are advocates and facilities. There are groups that are set up so that if a patient has a question, he goes into the group, whatever it's called in whatever facility, and there are people set in place to be the intermediary between those providing the service and those receiving it. And there are disenfranchised, uneducated people, but there's paraphernalia out there, social workers out there, community people in the community advising customers to assert and ask questions, not be passive. I mean, 30 years ago, you went to your doctor and whatever he said, you did. You didn't ask questions, you were afraid to. You were afraid of antagonizing, being victimized, and losing your anchor.
How many of
It's no longer true today.
How many of you are still a little bit intimidated by the doctor?
I'm not, but I know someone who is.
There are people very
well. Her doctor gives her these wacky terms for what's wrong with her that he creates. Yeah.
So it is a power relationship. And
like kicking leg. You know what kicking leg is?
No, it's called restless
leg syndrome. She's told kicking leg.
She was told kicking leg.
That's the medical word for restless leg syndrome.
Kicking leg. Restless
I was raised to believe that a doctor was sat on the right-hand side of God. And
that's what
was the most respected and person in the community, and you didn't question his authority. I learned differently as I grew older and wiser.
My father was a pharmacist, so I knew otherwise, because many times it was his duty to look at the dosage. Yeah?
Yes.
And many times he would catch the dosage. And even if the doctor had ordered that dosage, if he didn't take care of it, he could be blamed. The pharmacist, people don't realize pharmacists are on the line too. So he would have to call up, and which he did. He didn't have any problems until, I think, the latter part of his practice, when he was practicing, he said he hated weekends. Have you ever worked weekends? Because that's when people on drugs would come in with fake prescriptions. The doc that, and they would sign, you know, beautifully. And most doctors, not all of the doctors, their handwriting wasn't always legible. And of course, today they could do it by computer to the pharmacy. It's wonderful today. They could, you know, go online, and it's all very legible, too. And he said he'd have to check.
In those days also, they didn't even tell you what the medication was you were on.
That's
true. You just had to take the doctor's word.
He had to question that, or how much they were giving. And at one time, I remember at 5 o'clock, or 6 o'clock, we were sitting down for dinner, and all of a sudden, the police were at the door. We wondered, they said, we want to see your father. They took him off in a car. And we didn't know why, you know. It turned that he had reported something he was suspicious of, and someone was overdosing. And I think they had probably gone to two different doctors and had different, you know, had these several prescriptions, and so, but they went to the same pharmacy. That was the mistake. And so he reported, and he, you know.
You were left to worry about your dad when you got home?
Right. And nothing was said. They didn't say anything. They just...
Well, many's the time. There have been times when I've been rescued by a pharmacist, very gratefully.
Now, I'm just going to add, in terms of the social work perspective, in terms of hospitals, although it is true that with Catholic hospitals, very often the dogmatic issue can prevail and cause some ethical challenges mm-hmm. for staff, but also with secular hospitals, particularly the one that Sidel has a lot of experience in, and I was the largest hospital in the county that I ran services for seniors for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And it's really about money. Mm-hmm. And the social worker staff that had to discharge patients often questionably, ethically, mm-hmm. whether or not they were ready to go home. Mm-hmm. But basically, the hospital makes its money now with regard to the number of beds that are active. And there is a kind of pressure from on high down to supervisors to move people along. And we had to deal from our office with people that were sent home that obviously could not care for themselves. And there was no one else to care for themselves. And sometimes they were just left in the bottom of their own apartment or something, mm-hmm. and just, you know, the people would just go away. So, and really, I think it's driven by money. That's a basic, you know, mm-hmm. ethical issue that affects medical professionals and social work professionals.
Well, don't question that. It happens. Social workers have a certain degree of power too, and they can influence at the hospital does. They might have very much power.
Yeah. I had a couple of things. When I'm meeting a new physician, sometimes if I'm not confident in the relationship, I'll make sure that he knows that I come from the medical field. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I don't want them to know because I want to get a good, thorough explanation. Yeah. Then, rather than them assume that I know, but you know, they always know. Because after a little while of conversation,
you ask a question that tells them you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I use language that there mm-hmm. is, you know, you talked about the making up the words, but there is if you know the lingo, you forget that not everybody knows what hip abduction is.
Yeah.
Or something like, you know, that there's that there's an in, you know, it, as in every profession has its vocabulary. If I was a bricklayer, I'd have a vocabulary that not everybody understood. And the same is with medicine, is that you have a vocabulary and you get comfortable enough with it that you don't realize that other people don't know what you're talking about. So it gives me away every time because I use the right term when, because it doesn't even occur to me that it's a kind of an in way of describing something. But the other thing I was gonna say too is I heard a very interesting program the other day on radio that was talking about some research that people have done on the cost and quality of medical care in Wisconsin, and they used and the differences between various regions, mm-hmm. and they used the state contract because the state has to negotiate for their employees mm-hmm. to give a range of things that then the employees purchase. That's mm-hmm. part of how state employees get their medical care. And it's different, which I hadn't really focused in on. It's different depending on where you live mm-hmm. in the state of Wisconsin because there's different markets. So mm-hmm. Milwaukee market is different from Madison market, is different from Marshfield, mm-hmm. it's different from Green Bay. The costs of those are all different as to what the employees are able to purchase. And interestingly enough, Dane County had, and people who are contiguous counties around, our medical insurance here is less expensive than anywhere else in the state because we have a wonderful HMO system. And lots of competition amongst those places and for getting our dollar, the state employees. So we have the least expensive coverage available to us with the best quality. It was the conclusion that these people, I just thought that was so interesting. I didn't realize that there was that huge of a distance, but apparently it's quite a large discrepancy. And we're lucky. We're in that pocket where our health care is the least expensive for the best quality care. So we can all be happy about that.
Maybe you can't have it all. I went with a friend of mine many years ago. His wife had a burst aneurysm in her brain. She was a woman in her mid-30s, I think. We were in La Crosse. And so my ambulance went up to Mayo Clinic, and I went up with him and went in the doctor, and the doctor x-rayed and everything, and he simply said, I've done 600 of these operations, out of that, 400 have come out okay, 150 have become vegetables, and 40 have died. What do you want to do?
Oh, that's laying it on the line.
This is pretty cold. And we went back to the motel, and we thought about it, and he said, sure, go ahead. And it turned out fine. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, okay. So this person's pretty cold, but my guy can do that operation.
Yeah.
The other guy might have been really sympathetic and screwed it up.
But if he's only done five of them.
That's right. But this guy, he laid it out, just numbers. What do you want to do, Doyle?
Well, the Mayo Clinic is known for their insistence on good communication. At least it used to be.
Well, I hope it is.
Not only that, but they're also honest.
Because
yeah. I'm a patient over there.
So, yeah.
And that's the only place that will give you a refund.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, I've been to St. Mary's, Meritor, University, and the VA, all of those, and then they gave up on me and I went to Mayo's. And Mayo would send me a check for a couple hundred dollars. They were overpaid. You showed me a hospital then.
That's fascinating.
Okay, I think I'm next. I have just recently gone on a medical record system where I can look up my own.
Mm-hmm.
And and it's something that's just starting out, so you know I'm expecting there to be some glitches. But I now have a letter off to my general practitioner saying what I have observed in terms of my own records that needs to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing earth-shaking, but still, I think that's something now that we're all going to have to pay attention to.
Inaccuracies, you mean?
Yeah. And or something I didn't understand why it was on there, what does this mean? If someone other than you is looking at this, what are how it's going to be interpreted, et cetera, et cetera. And I carry with me my own medical records. I've got it in my handbag right now. I've got one out in my car. And I carry yours too. Because, and I'm not, you know, I can't say that all mine are complete, but I know what's on there, I know what's right, and it's in words that, you know, will help me communicate with the physician. And if I have to, like I'm going to New York, if I end up, someone has to take me to the hospital, yeah. They give my person, get out such and such, and give it to the doctor. Because I don't, first of all, the people who are actually doing the entry on those medical records are very, very busy people. And secondly, you know, they're choosing what's going on and what's not, what is not going on those records. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I think it's a great idea. If you know, someone can at least get some information about me, and I can't communicate. Yep. So, but I think it's something that everybody needs to pay attention to. If
people
if
are
they've
certain.
Got a lot of electronic records on you, be sure you know what's there and be sure it's correct.
People and you have to look up your credit report and see if there's errors there too.
I've been afraid to.
people tend to be much more.
Al's our expert on this.
Yeah, having had a career in medical informatics, and a piece of advice, use the feedback mechanism within that system,
yes,
rather than sending a separate letter, is much more effective, because reading that comment from you will happen at the same time when they have the medical record open.
Well, now the method right now is by phone.
Oh, okay, you've got the wrong provider then.
Well,
but any of the providers, there are two at least in Madison that use my chart of Epic systems, and in that,
yeah, this is my chart.
You give email back inside of my chart.
I'll look for it.
And that's the best way to give that feedback.
Okay, I'll look for it.
Because then it can happen simultaneously with opening up the record, rather than saying, well, I've got this piece of paper and later I've got to figure out what your record is. Yeah.
Good advice.
I'd just like to ask the speaker, what do you think of HMOs and how have they changed ethics?
How has Epic changed?
Ethics.
Well, certainly things are a lot different than they were when I went into practice in 1952. There was the whole responsibility was right with us. It was up to us as individuals. And in fact, we practiced in a small town in western Colorado where there were 8 physicians and there was only one of whom I would have trusted for myself or my family other than my husband. It wasn't a highly ethical medical community, and it may have been fairly typical of small towns in those
times. And the best one has been criticized for having reporters present when he took his own appendix out.
But he was honest. So it's true that the institutionalized ethics has certainly been helpful, but doesn't do everything that you might wish it did. Yeah, let's see. I mean, she has a question for you.
I have something to say about advanced directives. I've had an advanced directive for quite a while, and in that length of time, I had to go to St. Mary's and have a surgery. And I don't remember what the problem was, but I wasn't really on top of things really well. I was a little nervous about what's coming up. And a woman came into my room, some kind of aide, and she rewrote my advanced directive with me, changing what I wanted. And that was St. Mary's.
I don't think.
Would you sign it?
We're talking about a person. That's
changed,
much
I
discusses
signed it, but
later.
I changed it after I got out. I brought it back to you.
But I can make a general statement. I'm on the ethics committee in our hospital, and we talk a lot about advanced directives. And at one time, the surgeon said, we will not operate on someone with the understanding that we're going to let them die if there's a mishap, because that just isn't what we do. So, during the time of surgery, the patient is made to understand this advanced directive does not hold while you're in the operating room under the care of the surgeon. And you can see their point. Because some member of the family can come along and say, you mean you let mom die? Huh?
Mary,
yeah. Well, that was not mentioned, of course.
One of the things that I understand is that, and I'd like you to comment on it, that when you're admitted to a hospital, your own primary care physician has really no role compared to the admitting physician. And that issue of communication is something that I think a lot of us don't really understand. Mm-hmm. And is there any way of dealing with that?
I was ready to retire when I retired, but that's probably among the reasons. The trend to hospitalists has been a good thing in some ways. The hospitalists spend all their time in the hospital. They're on top of all the technology. They are 24, one or another of them, is 24/7 around on the hospital units. Theoretically, the personal primary care physician is notified that the patient's in the hospital, but unfortunately, I wasn't always even notified until after they went home. So although I would, if I knew the patient of mine was in the hospital, I would go visit and say, I'm here to visit you and talk to you, but I'm not taking care of you while you're in the hospital. But if you have any questions, be sure and let me know, and I'll. But I didn't always have the opportunity to do that. So that is one of the things, and our administration was well aware of that and kept working on improving the communication.
Mary, you're just, I just have to say that you're just a fabulous person. Thank you for being this today. You're one of my heroes. 60 years as a doctor is incredible. I'm just curious what you think are the biggest issues facing medical ethics, because, I mean, per your talk, there's a huge range of topics that fall under that. Well, what do you think are some of the biggest issues, and what should we do to get our arms around them?
Well, that's why I found this book so fascinating, because the things I might have thought before I read his book would have been, oh yes, it's patients having the right to determine their care at the end of life and their reproductive care. But now I see that patient-centered care, from an individual point of view, patient-centered care is of primary importance. The patient should have more say, and from a social point of view, I think the lack of power, the many groups that are lacking in power, deserve a lot better than they're getting. So this guy divides his time. He spends some time on a hospital ethics committee that talks about things like advanced directives, but he also goes around and talks to groups and spends some time overseas. And
somebody said that, you know, that the patient has more responsibility and take more charge of their care. Somebody said it's like being on an airplane and a pilot comes back and he says, we have a low oil pressure light. What do you think we ought to do?
Yeah.
And if you look on the internet, it's just more confusion.
Yeah,
it's almost hopeless.
Yeah, what the pilot should do is talk to a mechanic.
Yeah, don't talk to me. I'm just a passenger.
That relates to a question I have. One thing that really bothers me is the terrible overburden of drug commercials on TV. Aren't these illegal in some countries?
Oh yes, they were here.
Illegal. In New Zealand for a while, and New Zealand chose to make them illegal again. It was part of moving towards uniformity with Australia. And if it hadn't been for the fact that it was part of that package, the drug companies probably would have prevailed. But New Zealand and the United States, as far as I know, are the only countries that have permitted advertising prescription drugs to the general public.
Right.
And it's not only a waste of money, it's a waste of time talking about the purple pill, which isn't even pertinent to that patient. They wouldn't be talking about it if it wasn't for the ad. And you know why they don't always tell you what the pills are for? Because that way they don't have to get the side effects. So, advertising prescription drugs to the public is a big mistake, and it happened in 1994, and there were no hearings. It was done by administrative fiat, and it was on Bill Clinton's watch, and it was worse than Monica.
I think that's part of the whole basic ethical question. Should medical care be profit motivated?
No.
But is it the case sometimes where a person does learn something about
clinic?
A doctor advertised in our area about cataract surgery. Mm-hmm. And I knew a person who had cataracts. Just found out from that, said, yo, check it out. And maybe he could do some good. And he did. And if it hadn't been for that commercial, the person maybe never would have gone, never would have realized that there was help for his care. So it doesn't hurt to advertise sometimes.
But that's what a primary care physician is supposed to be.
That isn't necessarily the right person to do the cataract, so the one who has the most attractive ad.
Think about the guy who took out his own appendix.
In this case, it worked out fine.
Well, yeah.
That person got their vision back and wouldn't have otherwise.
Lawyers like those advertisements. Hmm? Lawyers like those advertisements because, you know, they advertisement for some pill, and then they say, in case you died, then please call one.
That was really obvious.
It's
kind of
crazy. What's your advice as to the best hospital you know of that's for profit in this area?
For profit? Well, I don't know. Are religious hospitals for profit?
No.
Well, it depends on what they're popping with. It's all from.
Well, Dean is for profit. And the art isn't St. Mary's.
I don't really know the Madison area hospitals that well. I think our hospital's an excellent hospital for some of the reasons I've made clear, that it's a Catholic hospital dedicated to care. And some years back, our vice president spoke to the ethics committee and said, I like to consider that we make money in order to take care of patients. We don't take care of patients in order to make money.
I had a horror story from St. Mary's.
That's a different person.
I have nothing to do with St. Mary's.
Yeah, St. Clair.
No,
she's talking
about
it.
Malpractice can happen anywhere.
Oh, of course it can. And I'm sure it's happened in our hospital.
I wondered about university hospitals, the fact that you're seeing my students some of the time, and whether errors are made because of that.
In general, I would say that the presence of students, what would you say, John, improves medical care because the teaching doctors are on their toes.
Yeah, you've got multiple pairs of eyes looking.
Now, it may be a little bit annoying to give your history to a student and then to a resident and then to the attending physician. But
yeah, my general practice person always asked, yeah, you know, would it be okay if so-and-so sits in?
Sure.
When I went to medical school, there was a patient who refused to sign the papers for surgery until she'd talked to her real doctor, who was the third-year medical student.
One more question.
I'm kind of cloudy at the distinction between profit and nonprofit because I have experience with nonprofit, and it seems they make a fortune, like $1 billion a year, mm-hmm. and their executives make salaries that are so unbelievable that you could throw up. And they're nonprofit, and I think the distinction is one, they hire from the community, they have a commitment to do that, and they don't even do any testing on the clerical level to bring people in to do jobs so they could read on fourth grade level. They're doing your medical input, your demographic input, but their skills may not be that they're on high school level when they graduate. That's number one. Two, the tax phenomena of how these organizations pay back is totally different when they're profit than nonprofit. But after that, they're making money, and they need the money to pay the exorbitant salaries, the increase in staff, to get the latest technology, and to pay executives to run it like a corporation. And so it could be nonprofit, but it's nonprofit for profit. We always laugh about that. But essentially, there's money left over in the coffers that go for whatever the executives or the boards decide it's going for. And a lot of that is the millions of dollars that the CEOs are being paid and their benefit packages. So that's just the way it is. I don't know about the religious hospitals, but I also see from where we come from, they're competing in the same pool, and they're competing against non-religious, secular hospitals. And they're getting fabulous physicians from New York City. They're doing incredible research. They're building and expanding. And how are they doing that? They need money. Where's the money? It's coming from their payer mix, Medicare, some Medicaid, and commercial payers, and however, they're not paying taxes because they're nonprofit. So that's a real confusion when we use those terms.
No, that's a good point. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the religious institutions have to survive. They have to expand.
Everybody's salaries are
expensive. Quick comment on Bob.
Hi, it's relative.
Whether you get good care at a particular hospital or not. University of Arizona one time treated a father of a friend of ours who was a Unitarian in Tucson. And he fell while he was living with them and had to go to the hospital, which was just a few blocks away, the University of Arizona Hospital in Tucson. It turned out that he got treated by interns who were not very competent, which led to his death in the hospital by being given the wrong medicines. So in this case, there was the hospital erred in giving these interns too much authority
to treat at least emergency patients. I don't know how often that happens, happening in teaching hospitals and that.
Incompetence isn't limited to interns. It can occur in people who've been in practice for 50 years. That's one reason we retire, right?
Probably right. I don't know whether that's pertinent to that.
Well, I don't know if it's an ethical issue or not, but I was talking to an acquaintance of mine who's doing an internship, a medical internship. And he said that just the way they run internships are horrifying, because you can be on your feet for 36 hours at one stint, and what kind of decision maker are you now? So I think that's a different...
That's an institutional problem that is being addressed.
Yeah. Yeah. With nurses, they're now looking at exactly that. How competent can somebody be who is sleep deprived? And it's sort of been perpetuated by, well, we had to do it.
We did it.
What's the matter with you?
It's like a rite of passage.
Exactly. But it's a rite of passage that's a very bad policy. And so I think I was reading somewhere that they're really starting to question that very thing.
That's terribly long overdue.
Yes, it's long overdue, but it is now under consideration, and we probably need to stop.
Let's thank Mary for her presentation.
I can see that everybody wanted to talk about the personal ethical issues rather than the big ones, but that's it.